course, when you're a young person, one of the first things you do when you write poetry is you try to create a world that both expresses the misery you're feeling in the world. You're feeling misery in the world, you see. That's what lyric poetry is partly about. It's ecstasy, escape from the world you feel trapped in. And so that's normal adolescence, to feel trapped in the world. And so we have rock and roll and dancing and a few other things, which we won't mention on a family program, that would get people out of their lives and give them some sense of release. But for me, poetry was that. It was an ecstatic release, both expressive of what I felt, but also it released me from what I felt. I could create a world. The first poem I ever wrote, it was like, I'm just walking around the woods in this upstate New York town, and the teacher says, oh, write a poem about this walk we took. And I wrote a poem about somebody standing on a rock by the ocean. And what the hell was that? You know, I made it up. But I thought it was thrilling to be able to make up a world, you know? And as I say, poetry freed something in me. And it has something to do with emotions and then the self. Whereas prose, the self, my character, would get embedded in circumstances and get embedded in the world. Well, look, I was embedded in the world of my family and my small town and the horrors that had happened to me. There was no way out of that, you see? There's just no way out of that by talking about it. So to me, poetry created an escape. Then, when I got brave enough and skilled enough, I tried to use language and poetry to write about my brother's death, to write about my mother's death, you know, to bring it back toward experience. But I don't think that was transformative either. I don't think that's what set me free. I think what set me free was the realization
moment.
That
the post-wacko moment.
The post-wacko moment, exactly.
Tell me about River Inside the River.
The book itself.
Yeah.
Okay, it's three sequences. The third sequence is a continuation of the previous two books, and there it's about the book of the beloved, and that we resurrect the beloved by writing poems and songs. And resurrect, I don't mean literally, but I mean emotionally, spiritually, in some sense.
Use the beloved. Now, what are you meaning by the beloved?
The beloved.
Hate to sully
sure,
the term
no, no, no.
by asking.
No.
But
it's,
so people
it's
can
always,
follow.
What's important? Okay, it's not Sufi Islamic mysticism, for example, where the beloved stands for Allah or whatever religious, a divine figure. The beloved is always a human being or a person or a place. For example, there's this wonderful poem called Jubilati Agno, written by a 17th century English poet named Christopher Smart. And he's confined to a madhouse because he's a little mad. And it's a long, long poem called Praise to the Lamb. It's a religious ecstasy poem. But 70 lines in there are about his cat, Jeffrey. And those are the 70 best lines ever written about a cat. Anybody who loves cats, as I do, reading those lines falls in love with them because this guy really knows his cat. And he knows, and he loves his cat.
And he loves his cat.
And his cat loves him. Yeah. And that's the beloved. Sappho, the ancient Greek poet, says, look, guys, some people say armies marching or a pirate fleet under sail or cavalry charging is the most beautiful sight on this black earth. But what I say is whatever one loves most is beautiful. And then she goes on and she describes this woman named Anactoria. And she says, that's what I love, the way she smiles and the way she walks. And you see that the human self can create meaning by saying, that's beautiful. That thing there is beautiful. That cat, that person, that tree, that valley I love. That's beautiful. You're creating meaning, you see? And here are these, some people say, these are the Greek male poets. Some people say an army marching. The hell with that stuff, you know? That's violence. That's destruction. And that's what the Greeks did celebrate, a lot of the male Greek poets. And she said, no, you know, and it's huge stuff too. It's like shock and awe. It's giant armies. And she said, no, it's intimate. It's the beloved. It's the self and the beloved. And that possibility. Martin Buber talks about it as I, thou.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this desk, Buber's first experience of it, it's quite a, you know, 20th century Jewish theologian, I guess, or whatever you want to call him. I have no idea what you want to call him. Beautiful book. But he says somewhere, when he was a kid, he went to his grandfather's stable, and there was this horse there in the stable, and he touched the horse. And he said, when I touched the horse, it was a thou. You know, it was something sacred, something amazing. And he said, I touched it and it was a thou. I could tell there was something between us, this I-thou relation. And he said, I, then I, each time I touched it, I came back, it was still a thou. And they said, one day, I came in 2 months later and I touched its side and it was an it. It was just a horse. And you know, that's the mysterious tragedy excitement of being a human being, is that things are constantly shifting from I it to I thou. You know, the beloved is constantly appearing and vanishing, sustained by our recognition, sustained by our ability to say, you know, to bestow a blessing. Want to hear what Emily Dickinson said once?
Of course.
Okay, this is crazy. This is crazy. Like Jacob wrestles an angel along the river in Genesis. You know, this angel comes up to him in the middle of the night along the Jabbok River. And some translations of the Bible actually have God wrestling with him. They wrestle all night. And the angel dislocates his shoulder. But Jacob hangs in there. This is Genesis, right? Hangs in there. And then the angel, it's getting toward dawn. The angel says, I got to get out of here. I don't know why. He says, let me go. And Jacob says, I'm not going to let you go until you bless me. Okay. And so he gets blessed and he gets a new name, Israel. Emily Dickinson rewrites this. She's a lyric poet at the end of her life. It's one of these strange little letters she says. She rewrites that story. She says, audacity of bliss, said Jacob to the angel, I shall not let thee free unless I bless thee. Poet and pugilist, Jacob was correct. According to Dickinson, and I love her, according to Dickinson, Jacob was the one who blessed the angel. He said, I'm not going to let you go until I bless you, you know? And he was a pugilist. He was a boxer and a poet. Poets can bless. That's the power in poetry, it seems to me, is to bless. To bless your cat, Jeffrey. Lift it up into song. You know, to bless this tree you love in the yard behind your house by turning into words and turning it into the beloved. And when you bless, you know, everything we live with is loss, right? I mean, everything's gone. But when you bring it into a poem, you resurrect it and you turn it into a beloved, or you can. That's one of the possibilities of poetry, seems to me.
So we
this
have
is what
the...
we call religion without theology.
Yes.
You know, secular religion, whatever. The blessings are essential. The emotional, spiritual dimension of life is essential. But I think it's something we've created out of our power to love and be loved. And that mutuality.
All right. We have the third section of the book. It's
beloved. See, I always get lost.
I don't care.
Yeah. Well, that was just the third. Yeah. The first section is, it's a book partly also about words and what we can do with words, what we can create with words. So the first section is called Eden and After. And I was thinking about, we're imagining that when God in the Hebrew myth creates Adam and Eve in the garden, they use words for the first time, and how wonderfully new they must have been, and how exciting that must have been to use those words. And I have a kind of feeling that the words that are important to use are words that are like verbs, because they admit that we live in a perishing, vanishing, flourishing world, a world that's constantly changing. And so I think the story that I tell is how Adam and Eve discover that they want to use verbs more than nouns, you know, because nouns kind of trap things inside objects and stuff, whereas verbs have something flowing. And it's also verbs are between us, you know, like I love you. It's the verb that's between the self
it's
and the beloved.
It's a subject and an object, yeah.
Yes. And so Adam and Eve have a kind of a quarrel with God about whether you use nouns or verbs. And by choosing verbs, they end up essentially going into processes, including the process of love and lovemaking. And they move into the world of jeopardy and loss. There's no snake in my story. There's no evil. It's a misunderstanding about how to use words. And so they go out into the world. God is angry about their decision.
And then the second?
And then the second section is called The City of Poetry. And this was a city I imagined, which I'm sure is real, just like the book is real. It's a city where every time somebody writes a poem, this poem becomes like a house in the city of poetry, right? It just pops up there. Robert Frost writes a poem and it pops up there as a house in the city. And it pops up next to Emily Dickinson's houses and Keats' house and the Chinese poets' houses and all these, you know, every poem ever written pops up as a house in the city of poetry. And we can go there whenever we read a poem. It's like we travel to the city. And the city is just, it's always there. The house is always there, ready to welcome us. And we can stay as long as we want. you know, and so we travel to the city when we read a poem and we come back. And I also imagine, this is my pleasure, is to imagine that when the poets die, when Dickinson and Whitman and all these people die, they go and live in their houses, you know, and they're all hanging out together at the bars and enjoying themselves. And they've created the city, you know. I mean, we talk about, you know, the city of God and stuff and heaven and all these things, but this is a city that's a kind of mythic city in which people find consolation and joy and beauty and excitement, all sorts of imaginative emotional adventures. So this is about that city, imagining that city, but it also kind of follows, it's braided in with that is my own life story, so that when I first, at the beginning of the sequence, I talk about when I first went to the city, the first poems I read and the first experiences I had going to the city and how I felt at home there in a way that I didn't feel at home in the world. And by the end of the sequence, I'm an old man, you know, reciting these poems that I love, visiting the city, reciting the poems. Whenever I recite the poems I love most, I'm in the city, walking in the city. And I'm an old man made young again by the poems I love, you know. And so,
is it possible to read a poem from each section?
I guess I could try.
Yeah,
the problem is that they are sequences.
I know, so they are.
Because that's what I love, because I like writing lyric poems because they're intense and they're and I love that intensity. But on the other hand, I'm envious of narrative poets because of they can move through time, you know, and I love that too, moving through a story. I love to. So these sequences are nice because there is the story of Adam and Eve in the garden. Everybody knows it. So I can retell it. I don't even have to make it up because everybody knows it, you know. And the city of poetry, I think people can get it pretty quick. But what can I read?
Yeah. What can you read? I realized it was going to be difficult.
No, I know, but I've got to figure this out pretty soon.
Yeah, you got to do readings.
I may have to be reading.
What was the pub date on this?
June 3rd, I think, okay. Or something like that. Let's see. What?
Have you done other books with Norton?
No, this is my first book with Norton. This is Eve. Eve has a very positive attitude toward verbs and language. Yeah, she's kind of the hero of this. And she's kind of going to help Adam move toward the world, toward embracing the world and celebrating it. And each of the poems in this section, most of my sequences, they don't have any titles, but the titles in the first section have to do with infinitives, like to say, to do, to, you know, to name, to see, to speak. This is called To Say. Saying itself was a kind of seizing with love. Eve taught him that. She, for whom prayer was praising what was there, the world spread out before her. What else should she adore? Now, of course, if you think about that, you realize that's a religious heresy, of course. You're supposed to love the creator, not the created, but we love the world. So Eve urged him to him. And, you know, their movement toward the verbs is going to be a movement toward the erotic and toward love in its form. So this is called To Embrace. With their embrace, they chose each other. Which is to choose death and all that comes before it, sufferings and joys and infinite unintended harms, large choice for such small arms. Very brave, Adam and Eve. And then they go out into the world, and then this is the city of poetry. These are the first two poems from that sequence. I guess one of the things, of course, from my life is I'm haunted by loss. I mean, I'm haunted by the way that things vanish. And of course, it's not just that my brother and mother vanished, but it's that they were never spoken of again. That kind of thing just haunts terribly. And so that notion of oblivion, it seems to me one of the darkest forms of not meaning, and creates the necessity to resurrect into song and celebration. Anyway, this is the first poem in the city of poetry. It would have erased everything human, the deep snow of oblivion, if those before us hadn't kept poking up the huts of poems, and then small houses huddled in a settlement, and soon it became a village, and next It was a town, and now it makes its own weather. Now the winds walk around it. Now the clouds bow. Now the snow recedes from the shining city. This is the city of poetry, which is also, of course, like the book. It's an architectural equivalent of the book, this things we gathered. And this is the one about, this sort of is the second one, and it has Adam and Eve being the first people to have built a house in the city of poetry. And it does a pun. The pun at the end is holy and holy. Holy as in sacred, and then holy as in completely. So I repeat the word holy, two different senses of the word. Some say Adam and Eve made it, she from her praise, he from his grief. Some say they built it out of their fallenness, he with his praise, she from her grief. Raising the walls, laying the roof, she with her praise, he with his grief. Building the first house of song, she with her grief, he with his praise. Making the holy human city, making the holy human city. And these are two poems from the last section. Doesn't the world demand we dance? Doesn't it insist on it? And why not? Look at the leaves. Look at the weeds. Look at the least blade of grass in the breeze. None of them begs off or offers excuses. None of them refuses. River inside the river. World within the world. All we have is words to reveal the rose. The rose obscures.
I want to ask you about Norton, because it's employee-owned, which means the guy in the mailroom goes to editorial meetings. Mm-hmm. And it's a for-profit company, and poetry, they do
a lot of poetry, a major poetry publisher among major publishers. Yeah.
And I'm wondering how you wowed the guy in the mailroom, how that went. Well, how you fetched up with Norton.
That would be a little mysterious. On the other hand, I have to say that the poems that I write now are very clear. I mean, they really are. Once, mm-hmm. if you don't approach it with an innate terror of poetry, which is what a lot of us have from our educational system, unfortunately, and from not realizing that rock and roll and poetry are the same thing, you know, that they're just all about, give me the beat, boys, and free my soul. I want to get lost in your rock and roll and drift away. I mean, you know, there it is. We want to be released. Anyway, so I think I gave a reading a little while ago at a university, and after it was over, the person who hosted me sort of, I think he was kind of puzzled. He was saying, there were a lot of older people there, people from the community. They don't usually come to these things. And that was nice, because what he was saying is that the poetry I write is not necessarily like, oh, this is incredibly hip. This is incredibly sophisticated and ironic and postmodern. In fact, it's quite the opposite, you know? And so, I mean, there are lots of professional poets that won't go near my work with a 10-foot pole, but I didn't think that's what poetry's about. I think poetry's about this basic human thing that we all share. And so I think actually the person in the mailroom, I'd love to read my poems to them. I mean, I love audiences that are not like hip poetry audiences, because I think there's, you know, there can be a lot of sickness in that hip, you know, a lot of soul sickness.
A lot of narcissism.
Yes, yes. And these are dark risks in our culture. Narcissism, solipsism, nihilism, all these things. And that's not what, you know, words were given to us, you know, to reveal the rose that the rose obscures, you know, to open something up.
And then I have one final completely off-the-wall question, which I probably won't use. But when I was reading the blessing, I was thinking, you have this large family, and you have a mother and a father of whom you would think of probably with complicated feelings. Whom do you look like?
A lot like my mom. Yeah, yeah.
I just wondered if you look
in
the mirror.
My younger brother also looks like my mother. And that was one of the things that I kept, you know, kept my fantasy that we were close going. I don't know whether we were or not, but yeah.
What have I missed?
I don't know. Nothing.
Nothing. No, that's nothing. Not true.
This is fun.
When I listen,
you missed anything? I'll come back and we'll get
come back. Yes,
it's fun.
See, I did miss something. Mm. How'd you come to write the blessing?
Well, I wrote it reluctantly. I didn't want to write it. My father was diagnosed with cancer, and it was clear it was terminal cancer. I had spent my whole life hoping that we could talk about my brother's death, that we could. It seemed to me we had shared this tragedy, this shameful tragedy with his killing of his best friend and stuff. Always felt that if somehow we could talk, that would be important to me. And I even thought to him, but I don't know. He never did, never would. And I realized he was dying, and we would never speak about it. And I thought, you know, if I don't separate my life story out from his life story, I'll go to the grave with him, you know? I mean, I really have to separate out because we're tangled up in this way that it's not good, you know? To be perfectly honest, I almost did die with him. About a month after he died, I had a ruptured appendix. And being a good doctor's son, I didn't complain about the pain. And it had burst 24 hours before I got to the hospital. I really was within a few hours of dying. So plus I was misdiagnosed by a doctor who was charming, very much like my father, but a bad doctor. Anyway, the writing of the story is, and this is why I think memoir writing is so important for people. It's a reclaiming the story of your own life, often against shame or suffering and silence. And that reclaiming is a way of growing because you have to write it and rewrite it and rewrite it. Getting down through the layers of fantasy and lies that you use to sustain the surface of things, and getting down into the mysteries where there are no answers, but there are many stories, if that makes any sense.